Irish Street Journal. Today's guest is Gav Lawson. Gav, alongside his brother Drew and friend Dan Sodergren, planted the seeds of the Hemp Trading Company, aka THTC, back in 1999. Over the years, THTC has flourished into an influential global streetwear brand with a thriving online community. Gav, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
So, what inspired you to start THTC back in 1999?
Well, the short answer, my brother, Drew. So, he was studying environmental politics at Hull and set up a hemp awareness society at Hull called Hempology, which essentially was, when he discovered about all the benefits of industrial cannabis, he wanted to share them with the world, starting with all of the lot up in Hull. So it wasn't a lot to do up in Hull back in those days. It wasn't the European culture capital back then. So within a couple of weeks, Hempology had become the second biggest society in the university, after the Football Society. And essentially they used to run alongside music nights and have a table where there'd be demonstrating all aspects of industrial cannabis, from hemp plastics to paper to textiles and so on. So I set up a similar thing in UWE in Bristol, and we'd essentially just give talks, and we were very new to it then as well, so we were as much learning as we were sharing, but it was really a panel for discussion. So that's what we then, 2 years after that, when I'd left uni and I went to do music technology in Kingston. At that time, we set up THTC, but it was still just an idea and a concept back then.
Okay, fantastic. So the majority of the clothing on your business is derived from hemp, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the high street today and high street brands, then I guess the overriding material used is probably cotton.
And nylon. And nylon? And synthetics, but yeah.
Yeah.
Cotton, really.
So how does hemp differentiate itself from these other mainstream fabrics?
Okay, well, first of all, hemp is not a thirsty crop. It's the third fastest growing crop in the world after bamboo and seaweed. But hemp itself doesn't need a lot of water. So compared with conventional cotton, it requires about 10% of the water of conventional cotton. Now, if you imagine a conventionally grown cotton T-shirt requiring 4,000 litres of water for one T-shirt, and if you imagine the kind of throwaway culture in which we live these days, Primark will sell a cotton T-shirt £2-3, something like that. I don't know, I've never set foot in Primark, but around a £3-4 mark, I guess. People tend to then wear it once or wear it a few times, chuck it away, and you've wasted a hell of a lot of water there. So essentially, you don't need any chemicals either. Now, it's important to note that the cotton that we do use is organic. You need a lot less water to flush out the chemicals, and the irrigation with organic cotton is a lot better than standard cotton. If I could make 100% hemp clothing, then I would. Excuse me. But it's still an expensive crop to grow and produce, mainly because it's not grown in vast production like cotton is. Yeah, you don't need chemicals for it to grow. You imagine it's a weed. It's very rigorous when it grows. It squeezes out other weeds, and you know, essentially, you don't need any of these nasty chemicals in order to produce it, in order to grow it or to produce it. Bamboo is a great fabric for. It's a great plant to grow for building, for furniture, for these types of things. But when they actually turn it into a viscose, it's actually, they use more chemicals than almost any other fabric. So the whole bamboo thing, unfortunately, is a bit of a greenwash unless it's sourced from sustainable sources.
Okay, so it seems like it's a bit more environmentally friendly. It's not as resource intensive. What about the actual fabric itself?
Well, it's come on a long way. When we first started, we went to Romania to have a look at some of the textiles out there. You can get various different weights and feels of hemp, but they've improved a lot. Now, it's a lot stronger than cotton. It's a lot stronger than most other fabrics. But for T-shirts, we really needed to have a very soft fabric. And when we started, we're not from a clothing background, we decided we wanted to produce hemp clothing because that's probably the easiest way to get the hemp word out there. I mean, you know, now if I was going to set up a hemp company, I'd be doing hemp plastics. No, all day long, it would be about hemp plastics. essentially, we decided that T-shirts were going to be the best and cheapest way to put our name out there. I had a degree in advertising, an HND in advertising and marketing, so I'm quite good with slogans and this kind of thing, so we figured t-shirts were the best way. Now, the fabrics were very rough back then. It was something, you know, we always used to joke that it had the feel of camel's pubic hair. It wasn't very particularly nice to wear. Now it's come on a long way. We mix it, as I said, with organic cotton, and the quality of hemp has just improved greatly. The more you wash it, the better it becomes, the softer it becomes, and it lasts forever. We have people coming up at festivals saying, oh, I bought this t-shirt 15 years ago and it's better than ever. You know, they really do improve with age.
That's amazing. Yeah. A lot of my t-shirts, when I go buy budget ones to take on holiday or whatever, it's almost like they don't even last a few washes before it starts fading and the material starts to degrade.
That's it. I mean, it does depend, because there's all different qualities of cotton, so you can get really terrible fabrics such as the Primark, for instance, or you can get very, very good quality cotton. But these are built definitely to last. The fabric is built to last for sure.
I hope you did primary market research on the camels there. Well, actually, I hope you don't. But...
not quite. No. I wasn't in charge of production then, but no.
Guskin does want to outsource, right?
That was my brother. Yeah.
So the law around the world seems somewhat divided when it comes to hemp. Have you noticed a change in the UK with regard to the law around hemp?
Yeah, I mean, the law regarding hemp production is intrinsically linked with I don't use the word marijuana, but the smokable side of cannabis. But essentially, you know, it's still there's still big barriers to growing hemp, which are still there from the Marijuana Tax Act back in the 30s, and essentially it was an intentional greenwash to outlaw industrial hemp. It's as simple as that. I don't know how much you know about the history of it, but it was mainly four different parties who got together to push through the Marijuana Tax Act and price cannabis hemp out of the market. That was Harry Anslinger, head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. That was Mellon Banks, Andrew Mellon. William Randolph Hearst, who produced all of his newspapers from timber, and he owned all the timber plants, and the DuPont family. Now, DuPont, after they'd outlawed hemp, they released nylon, which stands for New York London, which was essentially their first synthetic fabric that they wanted to replace all hemp textiles with. In recent years, it has got a lot better, predominantly because the states have seen the benefit in it in production. I think Uruguay had a big part to play in that because, you know, the Mujica, the president, legalized it and proved that you make sustainable businesses from it. But I think it's also we're in a position where environmentally we can't ignore hemp anymore. You know, it is the be-all and end-all savior crop for so many different industries. So I think people have realized, particularly as I mentioned plastic, I keep mentioning hemp plastic, is one of the most important byproducts of hemp. Because if you imagine every piece of plastic that exists in the world now could be replaced with hemp plastic, and it can biodegrade when you throw it in the sea. 3 to 6 months, it'll be gone. So, you know, it's not. I don't think hemp's going to go away now.
Yeah. So. I mean, that's absolutely incredible. And it's at a time where there's video clips surfacing on social media of people swimming through the ocean in Bali, and it's literally cluttered. There is just rubbish plastic everywhere. So the hemp plastics, so the actual product itself then is, you know, a proper plastic product until the time where you go to throw it away, and then it starts to...
Well, essentially anything you can make from petroleum, you can also make from biomass, so from hemp. So, you know, as you probably know, you can run a car off of hemp diesel without a converter. Rudolf Diesel created his engine to essentially run off of hemp biomass. Plastics, it's just plastics made from plants. Simple as that. So you need a sealant for it. But you know the plastic bags that you get to do your recycling, recycle the food, compostable bags. You chuck those on a compost heap and they biodegrade. It's exactly the same sort of process. The only thing is that, you know, if you're looking for a plant source to produce your plastics from, hemp's just such a fast-growing plant with so many different uses that it makes sense. It makes perfect sense to produce plastic from hemp.
Absolutely, we need to be doing that now.
Yeah,
really.
We should. And it takes the big companies to really do it. It does take. You know, everyone goes, "Oh, what are you going to do about the plastics situation?" I'm just really angry that it's got to this point, because it's not like governments don't know about it. And any piece of plastic that's been produced in the last 200 years still exists. It's only now that King David Attenborough, who I'm rocking on the T-shirt here, has drawn our attention to it, then everyone's actually sitting up and listening. But, you know, it's very sad that it's come to this point to do anything about it. But again, people are looking for alternatives to petroleum to run their cars off. And now the petroleum industry is finally dying, which is a fantastic thing. Then all the byproducts of it, such as plastic, are going to go the same way.
Yeah, and I'm being optimistic here, but I'm going to be bold. Hemp is going to be absolutely huge in our lifetimes. Yeah. Like, I'm seeing that shift now. People are starting to realise that. And we've talked about clothing, we've talked about plastics, but I've read somewhere that hemp has over 25,000 uses. Another really interesting one is the hempcrete.
Hempcrete, yep, for sure. There's a friend of mine, Tony Budden, who has a company out in South Africa, and he's built his house out of hemp, and all of his workshop and everything is all made out of hemp. But it's fireproof, it's mould-proof, mildew-proof, and you know, when, as I said, the more that's being grown, the cheaper it will become. And it's only going to become cheaper and cheaper.
Nice. So, yeah. We're getting him on the next show.
That sounds amazing. You definitely get Tony on there, yeah. He's in South Africa, but you can probably do it remotely.
Okay, yeah, that's a Skype one, I think.
That's a Skype one, yeah.
So what's the process from, I can see, picture a field full of hemp plants. How does that get turned into a T-shirt?
Okay, so the processing used to be a lot more laborious because you used to have to cut it all down and then lay it in the fields, and then you'd have to go into these massive retting tanks to soften the fabric. Now, there's been a machine called a decorticator, which actually, if you look on YouTube on The Power of Choice, you'll see a documentary about THDC from about 15 years ago. And we had a guy on there called Adrian Clark, an Australian who had developed this decorticating machine. It's taken so many years to bring it to market, mainly because of barriers through people who companies who have vested interests for hemp not to succeed. Essentially, this is a machine where you could feed it directly in, which separates the fibre, softens the fibre, and then you put it through a rolling machine.
So that's the full plant you're putting into this machine?
Yeah, you're feeding the stalks in, essentially.
Wow. Okay.
So you're feeding the stalks in, you've removed the leaves, and the stalks then create a fabric ready for spin. You then put that through a flattening machine, and then it goes into a tub with some enzymes, and it's not nearly as complicated a process as it used to be, and then it's spun, so it's spun like cotton.
Oh wow! Okay, yeah. That sounds a really cool machine.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Nice.
And I'm going out to the factories in May, and the guys I'm working with, I've been working with the same agents and factories for 17, 18 years, and they've given me permission to go in and interview all the staff and go through the whole production process as well and film all of this, which is great.
Oh, great. So you're going to make a documentary around
this? I'm going to make a mini documentary about it myself.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
I look forward to that.
Yeah,
that sounds good. Mm. And so I'm assuming this is abroad, these factories are abroad.
They're in eastern China, in Shandong.
Right.
So the Chinese are pretty much the only nation. I mean, there was a little bit that's been grown in Romania, and you know, but not really. There's not been a thriving hemp industry anywhere. And China were the only real nation when the US turned around and said, you know, cannabis is now illegal worldwide and refused to trade with anyone. The Chinese said, no, we're not going to stop it. It's been in our culture for 5,000 years. So they kept an industry going, albeit slightly dormant, but they have the mills and the factories and the technology to know how to use it. Plus, it's a great climate in eastern China to grow the plant as well.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And what's the hemp scene in the UK like? I had a quick look on the government website. So it looks like you have to apply for a license to be able to grow hemp. However, I didn't manage to glean too much more insight on how easy or not that is.
You do. We applied for one and we were granted a Home Office license years back to grow it, but then it's quite expensive. You have to pay to have a government minister to come out and check the crop to make sure that you're not growing a couple of weed plants in the middle of it, which would be pretty pointless anyway because it would cross-pollinate and they'd become useless. But yeah, you'd have to pay to do that. And then plus you also have to have an industry to sell it into, of course. And so, you know, to create a whole hemp processing plant in the UK was never really on our remit. It was a couple of brothers with a small hemp company. So we were forced to go elsewhere. But I mean, you know, ever since we started the company 20 years ago, we've been looking forward to the day that we can manufacture and produce local hemp, because every country should be able to do that. We shouldn't have to import it, you know. It's perfect climate all over Europe to grow hemp. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it is, at the moment, there are barriers, but hopefully, you know, as the industry picks up, it's going to be grown a lot more all across the world.
Absolutely. And if I was in the UK government right now and I was looking at Brexit on the horizon, I was looking at the risks that poses us to manufacturing industry, financial services. Really, this would be something I'd be going for.
Yeah.
We could build ourselves as the leader of hemp in the Europe.
We really need to, because we've lost our national identity, I think. We're quite in a bit of an embarrassment, I think, as a nation. But you know, I think this is a really good opportunity, as you say, for Britain to kind of take a defining role. You know, I didn't realise this, but a couple of weeks ago, a report came out to show that we're the biggest producer and exporter of medicinal cannabis, whilst classic British, whilst also claiming there's no benefits whatsoever. We're also growing and producing and exporting more than any other nation. So I think, yeah, the lies are going to be seen through soon, and we're going to have to start looking for our own green industries, really.
Yeah, I was left astounded at that United Nations report. I mean, it was something like 92 tons of cannabis, not hemp, but medicinal grade cannabis. Whilst a family and their 6-year-old son Alfie Dingley is fighting to get medicine with, I think, about 2% THC to treat his rare form of epilepsy.
Yeah.
Went over and treated it in the Netherlands for 26 days, did not have one seizure, when this poor child is used to having up to 30 seizures a day, which is a very poor quality of life, pumping him full of steroids. And meanwhile, this report breaks, which is just ludicrous.
Oh, absolutely, and this is one of the big barriers to the legality of the medicinal side, because somebody has to control it. Somebody wants to control it. It's all down to the finance, you know. It's a lot easier to keep people dependent and sell them medicine than it is to cure them.
But I guess this is a good point to touch on the differences between hemp and, to use your word as well, marijuana. And I guess the reason I'm not saying cannabis is because really they're both essentially from the cannabis plant.
Yeah, I mean, marijuana for me has racist connotations, you know. It always has since the word was kind of coined, and you know, it's a Mexican word, but it has very racist connotations. So I would say THC high cannabis, medicinal cannabis, or the active ingredient. But yeah, there probably should be a new word for it. So I just normally refer to hemp as hemp and cannabis as the psychoactive side.
And so the hemp it's non-psychoactive, isn't it?
It's non-psychoactive.
So it has like a trace of THC in
it? Tiny trace, a very, very small trace, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you've got some fantastic designs on your website.
Thanks.
for your T-shirts. And you've got a very, very passionate and engaged audience. You've got high-profile supporters, the likes of the Foreign Beggars, Beardy Man, Woody Harrelson, who's one of my favourite actors, by the way, Ed Skrein, Ed Sheeran, many, many more. How do you cultivate this engaged community?
So when I started, I just had a big bag of T-shirts and we had an idea. And what you do have as a company like ourselves is you'll always have people kind of rooting for you, because essentially you're going up against the big boys. You know, you're spreading some truth, and we became quite a cultish kind of brand quite quickly, because, you know, we were taking on environmental challenges. We were going to people in the hip hop industry and in the drum and bass scene who liked to smoke, but we were saying, look, this is an industrial side. You know, you might like your cannabis, but this is a crop that can actually save the world. And people got very excited about it. Now, we were a bit naive. We assumed that the more people knew about it and the mainstream media and the press would get hold of it, they'd go, oh, by the way, we can save the world with this plant. Have you heard about this? But it's taken so long for people to actually latch onto it. But essentially, you know, people need brands such as us, I think, such as THTC, to kind of be able to put their head above the pulpit a little bit and just tell some truths about the plant. So, you know, it's not so much guilting people into wearing shirts, but it's also people who are proud to be representing something like this. And it's not just the fact that it's made of hemp. It's also the fact that we, you know, produce everything by paying people a fair wage. And that, although that's massive now in the press, it wasn't then. So when I was calling up trying to sell THDC into the high street, into shops, the moment I mentioned fair trade, ethically produced, organic, there were negative words. People go, it's not for us, I know what fair trade clothing looks like. And we really had to break down these barriers and kind of redefine what ethical clothing and particularly hemp clothing was, because people thought of it, and still do to a certain extent, as, you know, a bunch of hippies selling T-shirts that are tie-dyed. You know,
yeah.
So we really had to change people's perception of it. And we were the first organic clothing brand, and definitely the first hemp product to be stocked into TK Maxx, into Virgin Mega Stores, into HMV, you know. So we really did kind of, you know, change things for people's, I think, for people's perception of what hemp is.
Kudos to you. It's very difficult trying to break people out of the mold sometimes.
It really is.
You seem to be doing a fantastic job. And
thanks very much.
You kind of the voice for the people here. It's
thanks.
Good.
Thanks. But I would say, you know, THDC, although it was my brother and myself and Dan, and then it was for many years, it was just me. And then we raised money from the banks and built up a team of 8 people 3 months before the financial crisis kicked in. And then I had to go through personal bankruptcy, business bankruptcy. I've had a fire at the screen printers, I've been robbed twice, I've been through it all. But what I'll always say is when I get knocked down, I always, you know, I'm very mindful of the fact that THDC has not just been me or the few people around me, it's been hundreds of really, really passionate musicians and actors and these people who you've just mentioned, who put their name to the brand and you know, shamelessly promote, you know, THDC and promote me and my cause. You know, I obviously couldn't do it without any of them. And they say, people say, how do you get these people on board? And, you know, it's a very slow process of meeting one, meeting two. They can see how passionate you are about it. And these are my friends. And that's my favorite part of my job, is that I can call these people, you know, my friends, you know, who have been my musical heroes and acting heroes for my whole life. So, you know, that's a great part of the job.
It's awesome. And you come across very authentic as well. And I think people can see through sometimes if you have some sort of agenda, and for you're building something you believe in, that you're passionate about, that's helping the world. And I think that comes across.
Right? Thank you very much, Francis. Well, I mean, what I would say is when I studied advertising at uni, and it was the only thing I was ever any good at, I got top of the year at UWE and got really good grade, and my teacher was trying to line me up with jobs in advertising industries. And that's the one thing that I said, is you can't pick, you know, if you go to this agency, you'll have to sell a fast food, you'll have to sell a petroleum. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. I don't believe in it. And I was very, very lucky. You know, not everyone is in a position where they can live rent free for several years. My parents supported me for the first, you know, for many years, and bailed me out and gave me the opportunity to do that. So I am mindful of the fact that I did have a lot of support from them. But I also lived on hummus sandwiches for years as well. So, you know,
it's got to be done.
It's got to be done. Yeah. It really does.
I mean, were your parents kind of supportive of this from the start, or did you come home and say, I'm going to start a cannabis company?
they were supportive in that I think they assumed it was going to disappear and never really going to take off. And it took a long time to take off, but they never told me to go out and get a job. I think the most important thing is, as long as you can pay yourself a minimum wage enough to be able to survive, then, and they can see it going somewhere, then, you know, that they were behind it. My dad passed away 16 years ago, so I'm, you know, gutted that he hasn't seen some of the more recent successes that we've had. But my mum's always been really, you know, behind what I'm doing. So
that's brilliant. If we go back to when you first started this in 1999, like, the needle has moved so far in terms of technology. Mm. Like, the internet was in its infancy then. Social media wasn't a thing. I did actually check. I think there was a social media company back in 1999.
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember the name. They went out of business, you know, okay, a few years later. So
yep.
Sad for them. They just missed the boat a little bit.
It wasn't MySpace. It was before that. Okay.
Yeah, okay, exactly. Well. So, you know, the social media thing is huge today. You seem like you've been able to keep up with this huge shift in technology, you know, very, very well. And today you're more relevant than ever. How have you managed that, and has that been challenging throughout the years?
It has. I mean, you know, as I said, for many years I did everything myself. And then 3 years ago, after we'd had this fire at the screen printer and I was about to jack it all in and I was just broken, a friend of mine came in and helped me, gave me a bit of startup money to get back on my feet. And I was just very aware of the fact that my skill set was so stretched. I was trying to do 15 different roles and social media was not one of them that I am any good at, and so I needed to bring someone in. So I brought in a guy called Ashwin Bolar, who now heads up all of THCC Digital. He does the website, does all the Facebook, and he's been great. I mean, you know, it feels like I've got someone alongside me to be able to delegate, which is so important, and to be able to expand. So yeah, Ash has played a really big role in recent years. But you know, by then, you know, I'd never really had time to focus on the social. So you know, besides putting a few posts up on Facebook, that was really my expertise. Fortunately, all these musicians and actors that I've been working with over the years would share stuff, and they've built up their own profiles. So if you picture Beardy Man, he's got 100,000 at least people on his Facebook. Foreign Beggars, you know, Trojan Sound System. These guys, they've got a great following. So you know, when you do photo shoots with these people, when you put a piece of news out and they share it, it really, really helps. So I think putting in that groundwork of building up the network and my little black book of contacts is the key to it. So yeah, social media has played a massive part, and also the high street's disappeared. You know, selling into shops in the UK has totally disappeared. So having a really good online presence is hugely important.
Great. That's some very useful insights there.
Yeah. And actually, it's worth mentioning, Ash and I are just setting up a consultancy for small businesses that want to get into ethical marketing. And I'm going to be pimping him out there as THTC's social media consultant.
Brilliant. Oh, I'll keep an eye out for that.
Cool.
And we talked about your awesome designs. You've got King David Attenborough there. Mm-hmm. We've talked about you being a kind of, in a way, a voice for the people and championing the hemp cause. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to say you don't shy away from controversy. A few of the T-shirt designs are somewhat controversial.
Mm-hmm.
Which one would you say is your most controversial, and have any of them landed you into trouble?
Okay, so, well, on the one side, we've just had to do a cease and desist last week with this design right here, which was designed by a girl called Flo, which is coming over here stealing our marmalade. Now, essentially, this wouldn't have been a problem before the Paddington films came out, but Michael Bond actually was pro this design, and he was the guy that started created Paddington. He was very pro Paddington being used as a refugee poster boy. He died several years ago. When they were about to release the films, this company bought all the rights to the word Paddington and to any kind of parody. Now, parody as a law has changed recently when it comes to trademark and when it comes to copyright. So even though this isn't Paddington, it looks like him and it's got the word marmalade, and they came after me. And even though we were giving 20% to Refugee Community Kitchen for this design, they weren't having it. So we had to shut that T-shirt down last week. On the other side of things, we came up with the Corbyn, Ashwin and his mates came up with the Corbyn design last year, which was great for us. We raised a lot of money for Momentum. And then we had hundreds, because it's like the Run DMC kind of meme. We had hundreds of eBay and Amazon customers kind of putting their own versions out. But the whole point of us doing that shirt is that it was a sustainable, ethical T-shirt for Momentum and that we could give them profits. So we've had all number of people rip that one off. So I don't like having to trademark designs, but, you know, we had to do that. Actually, even NME of sadly last year nicked that design, and they took our pictures of Stormzy and Rag and Bone Man and linked it through to their website saying buy your Corbyn t-shirts here, and printed them on crappy Gildan t-shirts. So I've had to protect that as well. So when we have a particularly strong slogan, I have to trademark it because people will just knock it off.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's incredibly frustrating that these controversial T-shirts and designs that you do, as you say, like a proceeds of this actually goes towards helping people, helping different causes, very, very worthy things. So
yeah,
it's one thing people ripping off your designs, and then it's another, then none of them are doing any of that groundwork and socioeconomic.
That's it, yeah. I mean, it's more than just a T-shirt, you know, it really is. It's a whole concept and a whole idea behind it to try and help ethical business. So, yeah, unfortunately, that's what we have to do.
Okay, so one last question for you. Who inspires you?
Well, my brother inspired me to start the company, and Dan. My dad, you know, my parents were always a massive inspiration. They got me into Attenborough, into that kind of thing, into going exploring the great outdoors. And I grew up in the middle of nowhere in the countryside. They were massive. When it comes to brands, Patagonia, all day, every day, you know, what they do, I think, is incredible. Lush, the cosmetics company, they put a lot of effort and a lot of money into promoting causes. We're actually at a Lush summit about a month ago, and they're very, very inspiring. Mau Mau, our designer, who comes up with a lot of the designs himself, which we then put onto T-shirts. Without Mau Mau, there'd be no THTC. I'd probably have a proper job and be earning a lot more money, so I blame him entirely. But
probably less happy.
I'm probably a lot less happy. So Mau Mau, definitely. Steele and Morris, who were the guys behind the McLibel case, who essentially were handing out flyers about McDonald's years ago and then got taken to court by McDonald's, and they represented themselves instead of having a lawyer, became the biggest corporate case in legal history, and they really exposed McDonald's for the tyrants that they are, whilst, you know, not really worrying about themselves. I mean, they were massive for me. Giving up fast food and reading Fast Food Nation for me 20 years ago was a big point. Who else? Leonardo DiCaprio. I mean, there's a lot of celebrities out there who will pretend to be green. This guy, Leo, I mean, if I can get T-shirts to him, that's like, you know, that's my bucket list, because he really practices what he preaches.
Leo, if you're watching,
Leo,
listening,
if you're watching,
post this in your address.
Absolutely.
We've got some T-shirts for you.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of Woody Harrelson for reasons we've just discussed. He got himself arrested by planting hemp in his front garden just so that he could, so America and the world would then find out the difference between cannabis and hemp. I'd say I have a very good, very close friend called Simon, who last year had one of his legs chopped off. And he inspires me every day, because every time I get moody or a little bit annoyed about something, I think of him, and he's the most upbeat, awesome man, and nothing gets him down. So he's a big inspiration to me, and all the actors and all the activists out there who are putting themselves out there, whistleblowers, you know, all of these people who are doing something for the greater good of the planet, they all inspire me.
That's a fantastic answer. Thank
Thanks.
You. So I think we've just got time for a quick fire round. Okay, mm-hmm. So this is how this is going to go. Two options. Choose one. You've got to answer as quick as possible.
Okay.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how are you feeling?
Yeah, nervous. No, I'm good.
It's all right. They're not actually too bad, these.
Right.
They're not too bad. Okay, so we're going to start. Brown or blonde?
Brown.
Okay, red or blue?
Blue.
Circle or square?
Square.
Spain or France?
Spain.
North or south?
South.
Tube or bus?
Bus.
Tea or coffee?
Tea.
Okay, you can breathe underwater indefinitely anytime you want, or you can fly, but only at night.
Fly.
Okay, zombie apocalypse or alien invasion?
Zombie apocalypse.
Okay, one of these items you have to wear every day for the rest of your life. Crocs or a sombrero?
Sombrero.
That's tricky to sleep in. £1,000 today or £10,000 in 10 years?
£10,000 in 10 years.
Leon or Nando's?
Neither.
Book or film?
Film. It's close, though.
Factual or fiction?
Factual.
Okay, fantastic.
Okay.
Good answers. All right, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you, Francis.
Thank you so much.
I hope that was useful.
It was, for sure.
Cool.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, man.